Then the thunderous shaking stopped and the door flew open. Andrew stumbled back a few steps and ran outside with Selena. Car alarms were going off all over the city. Smoke rose in a dark pillar above the tops of the palm trees that lined the horizon. Andrew and Selena stood staring at each other in shock before hurrying to his truck. Andrew climbed in first.
"Just a tremor,"
Selena breathed as she entered the vehicle and slammed the door.
"How long does the news say we have before the big one hits?"
Andrew asked, dragging his gaze from staring sightlessly out the windshield.
"Who knows? Days? Weeks? It's not that precise. I'd guess it won't be long."
Andrew nodded and stared out the windshield, his hands on the wheel, wondering what to do.
"Andy, what if we don't find her in time? Mike sent me a message. He said we're packing up and heading for his grandparents' ranch in Texas to wait out the storm."
"Mike can wait out the storm in hell for all I care. I'm not going anywhere until I find our daughter."
Selena nodded and bit her lip as she looked away, her eyes drifting out of focus.
"I'm due for my shift at the hospital soon. I haven't even slept."
Andrew nodded.
"I'll take you home. I have enough leads to follow on my own for now."
"What leads?"
Selena demanded.
"The brother. I'm going to wait around and see if he shows up. If not, I'll try to track him down at his university in San Diego."
Selena seemed torn, still biting her lip.
"Seriously, there's not much you can do to help me at this point. If something comes up, I'll let you know."
"You promise?"
"Cross my heart."
"Okay."
Andrew drove Selena home to Malibu, then pulled into a gas station to fill up on gas and munchies for what was to come. From there, he raced over to Santa Monica to stake out the Claremont's place. After about an hour and two bags of potato chips, his eyelids sank shut. He told himself he'd just take 15 minutes. And then he woke up in the dark to the sight of red and blue police lights strobing through his truck. He sat up and rubbed the sleep from his eyes, staring hard at the police cars parked in front of the Claremont's home. There were 3 cars. He left his truck and ran up to their front door, ignoring the protests of several policemen along the way. 2 of them were standing on the front step, speaking with Rick and Tina.
"Hey,"
Andrew called out. The policemen turned, their hands on their guns. They stared at him for a long second, quietly gauging how much of a threat he might be.
"What's going on here?" he demanded, stopping at the bottom of the stairs.
"That's really none of your business, sir,"
one of the officers said. Tina answered,
"Justin is missing, too."
Her voice sounded far away, dull with shock. She shook her head.
"He was answering his email. But when I tried to call him, it went straight to voicemail. Then I tried his girlfriend, and she said he was supposed to be here."
Andrew cursed under his breath and spun away, running back to his truck. The police called after him, but he ignored them. 3 disappearances now. They had to be related. Either Justin was the one who had taken both girls, or else he was a 3rd victim. Either way, the only thing left for him to do was to head to UC San Diego and start asking questions around campus.
9. Andrew. 6 days left. It took Andrew 3 hours to drive from L.A. to San Diego. By the time he arrived, it was after midnight and everything was closed. He wouldn't be able to investigate much until morning, so he pulled into the nearest motel and booked a room. He wasn't tired, but the alternative was waiting in his truck until sunrise, and he wasn't sure he liked his odds out on the streets in the middle of the night, with all the looters and crazies emerging from their hiding spots. Andrew couldn't help but notice that his truck was the only one parked in the motel parking lot. The street it backed onto was deserted, and the highway on the way down had been suspiciously devoid of traffic as well. The only sounds to break up the ominous silence of the night were the ubiquitous screams of police and ambulance sirens, but how long before even those were silenced? Andrew strode across the blacktop. It was wet and gleaming, like blood in the motel's giant red neon sign. He pushed through the doors into the motel office, but no one was sitting behind the front desk. Stepping up to it, he slammed his palm onto the old silver bell 6 times.
Something thumped, like a person falling out of bed, and a door creaked open somewhere down the hall. A man in a sweat-stained white tank top crept into view holding a shotgun. Andrew slowly raised his hands above his head.
"I don't want any trouble."
"You here to rob me?"
the man asked.
"No, I need a room for the night."
The man crept toward the front desk, keeping Andrew covered with his shotgun the whole way. He recognized the make and model of the weapon, a Mossberg 500 Bantam. The guy holding it had a shiny runway strip on his head between two thinning tufts of long, greasy brown hair that were sticking out at odd angles above his ear. He bore a striking resemblance to Krusty the Clown. A hairy belly peeked out right above the band of his boxer shorts. All he needed to complete the look of middle-aged desperation was a soggy cigar butt dangling from his lips.
"A room, huh? Are you crazy? Or is that just where you're going to stash your loot for the night?"
"What? No, no loot.
I'm here for my daughter. I just drove from L.A. I'm looking for a place to lie low until UC San Diego opens in the morning. I figured my chances of making it through the night undisturbed would be better with a door and a lock than sitting in my truck."
"Yeah,"
Krusty grinned and nodded slowly.
"Sure, that makes sense."
"So, how much for the night?" Andrew asked.
"How much you got?"
Krusty replied. There was a nasty gleam in his eyes that brought Andrew's guard screaming up. He glanced wistfully at the doors behind him and his truck waiting out in the lot. He had a pistol in the glove box. He should have brought it with him.
"What's the matter?"
Krusty asked.
"Someone waiting for you out there? Are you the bait?"
Andrew heard the action of the shotgun rattle as Krusty raised it to his shoulder. He turned back around and summoned what he hoped was a nonchalant expression.
"No, it's only me."
Krusty's gaze darted over Andrew's shoulder to his truck and back a few times, as if he was waiting for someone to jump out.
"All right, then. Hand your wallet over, nice and slow."
"Okay, okay, take it easy," Andrew said. He slowly lowered one hand to his back pocket and withdrew his brown leather bifold.
Krusty spared a hand from his shotgun to pocket the wallet and his boxers, not bothering to check the contents.
"He's lucky he has side pockets," Andrew thought. "Or maybe I'm the lucky one. Where would he have put my wallet if he didn't?"
Andrew shrugged. "That's all I've got."
"Yeah? What about that phone of yours?"
Krusty nodded to the rectangular bulge in Andrew's jeans pocket. He grimaced and removed the phone, handing it over. Again, Krusty switched to a one-handed grip on his shotgun, this time balancing the stock under a hairy, sweaty armpit while he examined the phone.
"Nice. Latest model Samsung, huh?"
Andrew nodded.
"That might fetch something. What's the lock pattern?"
"A V, as in veteran. That's who you're robbing, by the way."
"No shit. Thanks for your service, man."
His gaze dipped to the phone to try the code. Big mistake. Andrew sprang forward, grabbing the shotgun barrel in both hands and forcing it out of line with his chest. A split second later, it exploded in his grip as Krusty pulled the trigger. Glass shattered behind him and Andrew's hands went painfully numb as pins and needles raced up both his arms. He ignored the sensation and ripped the shotgun away in one smooth motion. Krusty's beady black eyes flew wide, and he lunged after the weapon, but Andrew was far too fast for him. He withdrew in two quick steps, pumped a new round into the chamber, and aimed the gun at Krusty's chest.
"Hand the wallet over, now."
"Sure, man,"
he said, licking his lips and smiling like a true psycho. Krusty placed the wallet on the desk between them, too close for Andrew to safely reach for it.
"And the phone."
Andrew nodded to where Krusty had dropped it in their brief struggle over the gun.
"Pick it up."
Krusty smiled, but he made no move to comply.
"Go ahead and shoot me. That's the new law, kill or be killed. It ain't murder. It's survival. No one blames a lion for killing a deer.
Lions and deer don't even live on the same continent.
They do these days,
Krusty said, his eyes gleaming like black pearls.
Shoot me.
If you have a death wish, you're going to have to fulfill it yourself. Now pick up my phone.
No.
Fine.
Andrew flipped the shotgun around and smashed the stock into the man's forehead. Krusty stumbled back a step, blinking in a daze. Andrew swept in behind him and yanked the gun up under his chin, pulling it hard against his throat. The man's hands flew up, trying to push the gun away, but Andrew was stronger. Krusty tried donkey kicking a few times, but he wasn't flexible enough to reach anything vital, and Andrew's shins could take some kicks. It wasn't long before the fight left the man entirely, and he collapsed on the floor in a stinking heap. Andrew's nose wrinkled at the sweat smell now clinging to him.
Idiot, he muttered, even as he checked the guy's pulse. Still going strong.
He stood up and left the clown lying behind his desk to conduct a quick search of the area. He checked the man's bedroom first and found actual handcuffs and keys in the nightstand. He snatched the handcuffs out of the drawer, trying hard not to think what they might have been used for, and tossed the keys under the bed. Back at the front desk, he used the cuffs to chain the guy to a metal beam that made up part of the desk. The middle-aged motel owner groaned and stirred where he lay, his wrists now bent at an awkward angle. Andrew straightened and plucked the phone off the desk, snapping the cord before tossing it aside. Andrew spared a rueful glance at the motel owner before grabbing a room key off a rack on the wall. He took the shotgun with him and stalked out of the office. Eventually, the owner would find a way to drag his desk into the bedroom, and he'd find the keys for the handcuffs under his bed, but by then, Andrew would be long gone. 5 minutes later, he was lying on a bed that he didn't have to pay for in one of the motel's many vacant suites. The shotgun leaned against the nightstand beside him for company. Having slept all through the day while staking out the Claremont's home, he wasn't the least bit tired. Probably just as well. But idleness soon turned to worry. And worry to naked terror as he contemplated how many hours had passed since Val had disappeared. The alarm clock on the nightstand showed 2:39 a.m. Tuesday already. Val had gone missing at about 10 a.m. on Sunday morning, at about the same time that Selena had been bailing him out of jail. He remembered reading somewhere that the first 48 hours of a missing person's investigation were the most critical. After that, the trail typically went cold. By the time he could snoop around UC San Diego, it would have been almost exactly 48 hours. Andrew gritted his teeth, vowing to rain hell fire on whoever had abducted his daughter. Kendra. There were far more people remaining at the University of San Diego's campus than Kendra had expected. Some students milled about, and she stopped a pair of young men on her way towards the registrar's office.
"What's going on? Are classes still taking place?" she asked one of them.
He looked her up and down, obviously judging her pantsuit as a sign she wasn't a freshman.
"We were just told the semester's been put on hold. Can you believe it? They really have faith in this crap about the storms. I bet we don't even see rain," the guy said, slinging his pack higher up on his shoulder.
"Thanks," Kendra said dryly.
She headed to the main office and pushed through the unlocked doors. A red-eyed woman sat at the front desk, her hair a mess, her clothes wrinkled.
"Can I help you?"
The words out of her mouth were robotic. Kendra cleared her throat.
"I'm Special Agent Kendra Baker, and I'm here to talk about Professor James Hughes."
The woman's eyes went wide behind her plastic-framed glasses.
"Mr. Hughes isn't here."
"I know. I'd like to speak to someone about him."
A man appeared from down the hall, sporting a tweed jacket and khaki pants, nodding to the receptionist.
"It's all right, Bonnie. I'll talk to Ms. Baker."
He was older, maybe 60, and had perfectly coiffed hair. He smelled like English leather, even from across the room. The exact opposite of Bonnie.
"Thank you, Mr.
Kendra showed her badge, even though he hadn't asked to see it, and he nodded, turning to lead her to his office. It was stuffy, the lights dim, and the window coverings closed.
Carl Manson. With everything going on out there, I'm surprised to see the FBI sniffing around for one missing man. The police didn't seem interested in the least, the man said with the hint of an English accent. She guessed his parents had emigrated from England when he was young.
I've noticed a trend, and I'm hoping you can help me out. The report didn't indicate much about what happened, only that Mr. Hughes was gone,
Kendra told him.
That's because the police couldn't get out here sooner. James was absent last Thursday, which in itself didn't cause us alarm, but on Friday we began to suspect he was sick or had been hurt, with the warnings starting to trickle in about the inevitable catastrophe. At first I thought he might have headed inland, like countless others. We've had four professors and half of the students absent for some time now, but James wasn't like that. He was dedicated and always considerate. I checked his house, Carl said.
Kendra made notes on her tablet.
You checked his house?
He nodded.
There was no sign of forced entry, and his car wasn't there, so I came here and watched the footage.
The footage? You have surveillance?
Kendra asked.
Let me show you,
he said, flipping his desktop monitor around on his cluttered desk. He opened a program and found the correct file, playing it for her. She watched as a man, presumably James Hughes, slid into a compact blue hatchback and began to drive off. A black Tesla pulled behind him, following him from the parking lot.
"That's it?"
she asked.
"That's it."
"May I?"
she asked.
"Be my guest,"
he said, relinquishing his chair for her. It was much more comfortable than the hard one she'd first been offered. Kendra flicked through the feeds and found another angle. This one was from 5 minutes earlier as the Tesla arrived. She paused the video and zoomed on the plate, marking the details down. 6, Tango Romeo Juliet 2. The last two digits were blurry. She fought for another angle, but the limited surveillance resources at the university made it impossible to obtain a better viewpoint. Kendra scanned through the other camera's footage and found a shot she could use. The driver of the Tesla was wearing sunglasses, but she could tell he had short, dark hair and was wearing a black blazer.
"Excuse me, do you have a printer?"
she asked him, and Manson nodded.
"Just hit print and it'll come out," he replied.
Soon she had about 5 solid images. She'd spent a good day or so combing over the cases, and at least twice there had been mention of a black Tesla at the scene, as well as a tall Caucasian man with dark eyes and hair. This was the guy. She watched him follow James from the lot and realized she needed to find this man. He was the linchpin in the entire case. She could feel it in her veins.
"Thank you for your help, Mr. Manson."
She shook his hand and slipped her card on his desk.
"If you find out anything else, let me know."
Andrew. The next morning, Andrew gave the belligerent motel owner a break and fetched the keys to his handcuffs. He also returned the shotgun, minus the shells.
"You're lucky I don't call the cops,"
the motel owner said while massaging a red mark around his wrist. "Back at you," Andrew said. He left the office at a run, climbed into his truck, and raced out of the parking lot with tires squealing and engine roaring. Not long after that, he stormed the campus of UC San Diego, heading straight for the registrar's office. Inside, a woman with frizzy, tangled hair sat behind the front desk. She watched him as he approached, her eyes red from crying. "Hello," he said, pretending not to notice her distress.
"What do you want?"
she snapped. "I'm looking for a student who goes to school here."
"No one goes to school here anymore. This semester has been suspended, pending further notice."
"Okay, but what if I want to find out about a student who was studying here recently?" The woman gave him a disinterested stare, eyes blinking slowly, drifting out of focus.
"That information is private."
"It's tied to a missing persons investigation," Andrew said.
"Another one?" Or is this also about Professor Hughes?
Andrew's brow furrowed at that. A professor was also missing? Before he could ask about it, a door clicked open, drawing his eyes to the sound. Two people were stepping out into the hall that ran past the front desk to the school's administrative offices. One of them was wearing a tweed jacket, khakis, and brown leather Oxfords. The other was a trim, attractive woman with long blonde hair tied up in a ponytail. She was wearing a black pantsuit with a gray mock-neck sweater. Something about the way she moved caught Andrew's eye. Smooth, efficient, and fast, with long, no-nonsense strides. It wasn't a feminine, hip-swaying walk, that was for sure, and she was wearing black sneakers instead of pumps or heels. All of it added up to the same thing. Cop. Andrew also noticed that she was carrying a tablet and a purple folder full of papers under one arm. She appeared to be distracted by a hushed conversation she was having with Mr. Tweed Jacket. Andrew overheard snippets about Professor Hughes's disappearance and something about a black Tesla following his car. That caught his attention instantly. The neighbor who'd seen Val and Anna walking together in Malibu had seen a black Tesla coming down the same road only minutes after they'd disappeared. This was San Diego and that was L.A., but it couldn't be a coincidence, could it? Two black Teslas connected with two separate disappearances? More likely it was the same car and the same driver working his way down the coast. And who was this woman talking about that car and Professor Hughes? 10-1, she was a detective investigating his disappearance. Andrew's eyes grazed the purple folder tucked under the woman's arm. What was in there? Her notes on the investigation? He needed to find out. The woman noticed Andrew staring at her, and she pursed her pretty red lips as she frowned. He looked away quickly and flashed his most charming grin at the teary-eyed woman behind the front desk. "Thank you. You've been a big help," he said just before spinning away from the desk. He judged the moment perfectly. Andrew slammed straight into the detective, knocking the tablet and the folder out from under her arm. "Oh, shit, I'm sorry," he said. "Are you okay?"
"I'm fine," she said in a clipped tone. She began bending to collect her scattered papers.
But Andrew beat her to it. "Here, let me help you," he said, grabbing the files and committing each of them to memory as he shuffled them into the purple folder. The papers were all printout stills of a black Tesla sedan. One of them showed a driver in a blue suit with dark glasses. Another showed the license plate. 6, Tango, Romeo, Juliet, 2. The last two digits were too blurry to make out, but he repeated them over and over in his head so he wouldn't forget.
"Here you are," he said as he straightened and handed the folder and the tablet back to the woman.
"Thanks," she replied in the same annoyed tone, and he could tell that it cost a lot for her to say that much.
The subtle pinching around her eyes suggested she was also suspicious that maybe he'd bumped into her on purpose. Mr. Tweed had a pinch-eyed look of his own. Andrew needed to distract them, to give them something else to focus on.
"You know, you could be a little more gracious about it," he said. "After all, you bumped into me."
The woman's eyes flashed, and she shook her head incredulously.
"You're joking, right?"
"No. I was simply turning away from the front desk here," he gestured to it, "and then bam, you barrel right into me and act like it's all my fault. I mean,"
Andrew tried on a smirk for good measure,
"that's pretty rude. Maybe you should be apologizing to me."
"I don't have time for this bullshit," the woman said, brushing past him.
"Sir, I think it's time for you to leave," Mr. Tweed added.
"There she goes again. Tell me you saw it that time," Andrew demanded. He nodded to the woman's back as she headed for the doors, her ponytail bobbing angrily as she went.
"Sir," Tweed said in a warning tone.
Andrew ignored him and ran after the woman, grabbing her by the shoulder.
"Hey, you need to be—" She spun out from under his grip and pulled out a badge.
"You see that?"
she said.
Yeah, he trailed off, pretending to be surprised as he studied the badge. Special Agent Kendra Baker, FBI. That was one better than he'd expected.
His eyes widened, and this time it wasn't just for show. Time to drop the act. She might actually be able to help him if he leveled with her.
All right, Miss Baker, I'm really sorry, but I'm here from L.A. looking for my daughter. She went missing, and the last person to see her was a friend of hers. The friend's brother goes to this school, and it appears that he's vanished as well. The three of them were supposed to meet up on Sunday, and now no one knows where they are. A slight frown creased Kendra's lips, and her eyes searched his briefly before she gave in with a sigh and shook her head.
They're not the only ones missing. There's been a wave of abductions along the coast. Have you spoken to the police?
Yes, they were worse than useless.
Well, I don't know what to tell you other than I'm working on the case. Here.
She walked over to the registrar's desk and snapped her fingers at the shell-shocked woman sitting there.
Pen, paper.
The woman passed those items over, and Kendra, in turn, passed them on to Andrew.
Give me your daughter's name and description and a number where I can reach you.
Andrew obliged, writing down as many details he could think of. He added both his cell number and Selena's, along with each of their names.
Now what?
He asked as he handed her the piece of paper. Kendra slipped it into her folder, along with the stills of the Tesla.
Now you go home, or better yet, you evacuate somewhere safe and wait until I call you.
Andrew scowled, but said nothing to that.
Do you understand me? We don't need any more loose cannons running around.
Yeah, sure, I get you, Andrew said, borrowing her clipped tone from before.
Good.
Kendra spun away and pushed out through the glass doors on her way to the parking lot. Andrew waited a few beats and then followed her out as casually as he could. Agent Baker had just become his next lead. Hopefully, she would guide him to whoever had taken Val. Kendra glared in the direction of the university. That man had sent her over the edge. His brusque manners and forceful voice reminded her of too many cops she'd dealt with over the years. She spotted him getting into a black truck and hoped that was the last she'd see of the guy. She didn't quite believe his story about the girl, but there was desperation in his eyes. That much was clear. She had other places to visit today, so she made herself dismiss the interaction as she drove away. The radio was on, the soft, droning voices threatening to put her to sleep. She turned the knob, hoping for music, but no one was playing that anymore these days. It was all doom and gloom. She tapped the volume up, anxious to see what they were rambling on about today.
The anti-eruption technology is new, not ready to be used, but we have no choice. I say we head to the lab, grab the damn device, and march it straight to Yellowstone. What do you say, Brian?
The man was clearly the guest, not a practiced radio personality.
As much as it pains me to agree with you, Don, I think you might be correct. Projections put us at 6 days from doomsday. Can you believe it? If everything they're warning us of comes true, we won't be around to worry about it soon, the host, Brian, said to the guest.
Then who's with me? I'll be leading the charge, traveling to the facility outside Twin Falls. We'll force them to take action. What can it hurt?
Don asked, his voice nearly frantic. Kendra shook her head, imagining the crazed public tearing down the walls of some insignificant research facility so they could drive to the danger zone of Yellowstone to throw a mythical anti-eruption device into the gaping maw. It was like throwing a virgin into the lava on Hawaii, placating some ancient goddess. She changed to another station as she drove, heading south for the naval base. Traffic was dense. People were in terrible moods, honking at each other and yelling threats from their lowered windows. She hated the vibe of the city lately, the tension palpable everywhere she went.
The droughts have been going on for months, years, in parts of Africa. Even if disaster doesn't strike like predicted, half of the continent will be dead in 6 months, and that number will escalate with the toxic fogs spreading farther with every passing week. Things are dire on this planet and have been for a long time. We have evidence that similar events have occurred in the past, though it's not public knowledge. Back then, there were very few people, and they didn't have the technology or reference to understand what was happening. This is a cycle,
a woman said. Her voice was cultured, reminding Kendra of a co-worker that had attended Harvard.
And you think this means what? The speculation is real? Will Earth be able to recover?
A man asked. A slight pause.
It will recover, yes.
And us?
Time will tell,
she answered. Kendra took that as a no.
If this is the end of the world, where are you going, Dr. Fran? The host asked.
I'm at home with my family.
What can we do?
The woman's voice was strained.
Pray.
Kendra tapped the radio off, the hair on her neck standing up at the word. Pray.
10. Kendra, 6 days left. Traffic was slow-moving as she wound her way to the naval base, but she made it there eventually in the silence of her car. She couldn't stand to hear the radio any longer. It was only distracting her from the job at hand. Kendra arrived at the Navy site and noticed that much of the stationed Pacific Fleet had evacuated from the docking area. Only a handful of aircraft carriers sat alongside a few cruisers now. She drove to a building that acted as a gate, and a uniformed officer knocked on her window. She rolled it down and flashed her badge.
I'm here to see Captain Henry Truman.
The man eyed her suspiciously.
Do you have an appointment?
Listen, the world's going to hell, and I'm not here on a social call. Tell him Special Agent Kendra Baker has a few questions about Tess Anderson. I don't have all day.
Kendra used her no-nonsense voice, and the man's eyes jumped open at the mention of Tess's name. He nodded and held up his hand for her to wait while he contacted the captain. Kendra glanced in the rearview mirror. No other cars were lined up to gain access to the base. She wasn't surprised to see the parking lot so deserted. That was becoming a common occurrence in town. She wondered how many people had fled the coast by now. It had to be at least half of them, with more pouring away from San Diego with each passing minute. Soon it would be a ghost town. She needed to act fast. While Kendra waited, she had the feeling she was in a huge hourglass, the sand dropping from under her feet until she'd run out of time. Then what? She'd be left at the coast watching the tidal waves come for her. Her heart hammered in her chest, thinking about it. It was difficult to not take the threats seriously, especially after hearing all the professionals discuss the looming disasters over the radio. She was convinced that doomsday was upon them. Why should she search for people that would only end up dead in a week's time anyway? Kendra tapped her foot on the brake and moved the shifter to reverse, but then the naval officer waved her forward, lifting the arm of the blockade. She spent half a second making a decision and imagined her sister's face the last time she'd seen her. Kendra put the car back in drive and forced a grim smile for the officer as she drove past him and into the base. She drove around a small traffic circle, following the signs to the main office. A quick left and she veered right on the deserted streets, pulling up facing the brick building. For an operation like this, the entire base felt underwhelming, especially with it being deserted. Kendra moved for the doors, and a man was waiting for her inside. He appeared exhausted, with black bags under his eyes and deep lines across his tall forehead.
"Agent Baker?"
he asked, sticking out his hand.
"Captain Truman, I presume?"
she replied, shaking in greeting.
"What do you expect to find here?"
he scanned to her left hand.
"Miss Baker?"
"What can you tell me about Tess Anderson?"
she asked. They sat in the foyer on two hard metal chairs, the kind every building like this had near the entrance. She turned to face him as they talked.
Commander Tess Anderson is a fine woman and a great officer. She ran off a week ago, he said.
Ran off?
I don't know what else to tell you. We've been aware of the coming storms for a long time. We run the largest fleet in this part of the world, and the tectonic plates have been causing trouble for years. Things have been escalating up to this point, and not just in the Pacific Rim, either. Do you think it's a coincidence we have poles melting, fault lines expanding, hurricanes doubling in size, and 70% of the world's volcanoes threatening to erupt simultaneously? Truman asked, and he looked as though he'd aged another 10 years in the span of his speech.
No, I mean, I haven't thought about it, Kendra admitted.
It's not. The Earth has forsaken us, and we're not living through this one.
Goosebumps rose on Kendra's arms, and she crossed them over her chest.
What are we supposed to do?
He changed the subject.
Tess ended her shift, and we met briefly to discuss options. She told me she had a brother in Florida. She was going to head there, taking her chances with the hurricanes over the ash clouds that will wreak havoc across our country.
So, you think she did that?
Where else would she have gone? Truman asked.
Do you have surveillance here?
It was an obvious question. Why are you here?
Tess's husband called a missing persons report into the police station, and I'm working on an elaborate case. I think she was abducted, along with some other prominent members of the state of California, and I intend to locate them.
Kendra's voice was low, and she saw something break in the hard man beside her.
Dear Lord, what good is any of this going to do? We'll all be dead soon enough,
he said.
If that's so, why are you still here?
She asked him. Truman leaned over his knees.
My wife left 10 years ago. No kids. I figured what else is a captain good for if he won't go down with his ship?
Show me the footage, she told him,
and he nodded.
This way.
10 minutes later, Kendra found the date she was looking for, cramped in a stuffy room with 5 monitors and an archaic computer. Truman brought 2 cups of black coffee in with him and settled beside her as she scrolled through the cameras.
You say she left around 7, Kendra asked.
Yes, he said.
She switched the camera and saw Tess enter into a gray minivan.
There she is.
Truman pointed, and Kendra pulled up the feed from the gates, finding what she was waiting for. A black Tesla. Her fingers twitched as she moved to the reverse angle. There she found something important, the entire license plate number. She'd asked the local PD to run the partials, but they hadn't managed to find it yet. Now she had the bastard. The feed continued, and she watched as Tess drove away from the base, the black Tesla following closely behind.
Find what you needed? Truman asked.
They stood, and the entire room shook, her coffee splattering on the keyboard. Truman looked grim as the shaking settled, and he held her by the arms.
Earthquake,
she said, stating the obvious.
It's only the tip of the iceberg, he told her. Get out of here. Go find a rock to crawl under. It's every man and woman for themselves.
Kendra freed herself from his grasping hands and left him there, alone.
Just get me the plates, will you?
She urged Barry at her field office, her cell phone pressed to her ear as she flipped through her files.
Sure thing, it might be a while. There aren't many of us left, and you should hear some of the things coming down the pipeline, Barry said in her ear.
Barry, don't mess around. This is important.
She'd already called the local PD, and she was in line there as well. Nothing was being done as pandemonium raged around the coastal city. Here at the outskirts of town, she found a sense of peace, almost as if the owner of the cafe was denying what storms were coming in the next few days. She sat at a table near the window and watched the waves hitting the rocky coast as dark clouds
began to drop angry raindrops. Someone opened the door, letting in a gust of wind, and she heard the voice of the man across the street.
I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth, as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. This is the end of days, people. We have sinned, and the Lord brings his final punishments on us. The man yelled into a bullhorn, and the door shut, cutting off his further preaching. The man who entered hurried to the counter, seizing every water bottle left in the cafe and organizing them in a pile. He didn't wait for the barista to help him. He flung a bill onto the floor and scooped up the bottles, dropping two on the way out. The barista shouted after him, but he didn't pay any mind. Kendra watched it all with a disconnected gaze. She needed to focus on her task at hand. She needed to reach this Mr. Tesla. He was the man that had the answers. If she found him, she'd find her missing people. The doctors, nurses, naval commanders, and biology professors. They were relying on her, and it was the only solace she could give herself before, as the raving man outside could attest, the end of days struck. Kendra figured it was time to go home as the sun was setting and the clouds were becoming even angrier. She gathered her papers and laptop from the tabletop and spotted the older Silverado through the window. She'd seen the same truck at the university, and the man's eyes bored into her soul from the street. The moment her eyes met his, she recognized him. He averted his gaze and peeled off down the street. She ran outside, leaving her things, rain quickly drenching her. She chased after the truck, but he ran the stop sign and continued on. She hadn't caught his plates, but that wouldn't do any good anyway, not at this rate. Had that man been telling her the truth about his daughter going missing? A teenage girl didn't fit the profile of the other abductees. Kendra, wet and tired, picked up her things and headed home, her cell phone close at hand, waiting for the call with the Tesla's address. She was so close.
11. Andrew, 6 days left. That was close, Andrew thought as he ran a stop sign to get away from the FBI agent. The idea was for him to follow her, not the other way around. The last thing he needed was to distract her from the investigation or make her think that he was somehow tied to the missing people. A crack of thunder boomed as he turned up away from the coast, and a blasting wind whistled around his truck, competing with the throaty roar of the Silverado's old V8 engine. Andrew wound through the city, weaving through the dense knots of traffic snaking out of the city. Most of those cars seemed to be headed for the interstates. He checked his rearview mirror periodically to make sure the FBI agent wasn't following him in her silver Prius, but there was no sign of her. After about half an hour, he realized he was just driving around aimlessly. So he pulled into a deserted strip mall and drove around the rear of a building that stood like an island in the middle of the vast parking lot. He took a minute to check the sight lines around him. No line of sight to the main drag, and he could only see slices of the side streets. Good. That ought to keep the FBI off his tracks. Looking back to the fore, Andrew noticed that he'd parked in front of a Dunkin' Donuts. It was closed, the windows broken, and donuts scattered all over the floor. A donut burglar? He wondered. The looters were getting desperate. Another peal of thunder boomed. The storm raged on overhead, rain cascading in solid sheets, turning the world to a hazy white blur. Now what? Andrew wondered. He leaned over the steering wheel and peered up at the black sky. Nothing to do but wait. He was waiting for a call.
Prior to leaving the university, he dialed his buddy, Ryan Drake. They'd served together in Afghanistan, but Ryan was working with the LAPD now. He'd caught Ryan just before the guy left the precinct. Back in Afghanistan, Andrew had pulled him out of a mess of rubble in the middle of a firefight. With that on Ryan's tab, it had been easy to persuade him to run the partial plates from that FBI detective's files. Unfortunately, with two digits missing, they were bound to uncover a lot more than one hit for a black Tesla sedan. A dazzling flash of lightning lit up the inside of Andrew's truck, followed by a cracking boom that shook the vehicle. The rain hammering on the roof was so loud that he would never even hear it if Ryan actually returned his call. Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out his phone to check. Two missed calls, but both were from Selena. "Damn it," he muttered under his breath, but he couldn't even hear his own voice over the raging storm. He needed a place to lie low and wait. He thought about going to another motel, but his experience with the last one made that thought less appealing. The Dunkin' Donuts looked like a good place to hunker down. If he was lucky, the power would still be on, and he'd be able to make himself some coffee. Of course, if he was unlucky, another group of donut burglars would show up and blow his brains out over a freshly brewed box of Joe. Reaching over to the glove box, Andrew yanked it open and pulled out his Sig Sauer P320. Best to be cautious this time. He ejected the clip, already full, and then checked the safety to find it on, as it should be. He shut the glove box and stared out at the raging storm. He didn't have an umbrella, but it would only take a few seconds to reach the eaves of the restaurant. Andrew removed his keys from the ignition and slipped them into his pocket. Taking a deep breath to steel himself for what was to come, he threw the door open and jumped out. He was drenched in an instant. Cursing loudly to himself, he slammed the door and ran up to the broken windows of the donut shop. His exposed skin began to tingle, then burn. For a minute, he thought that was because of the cold, but then he realized that it was the rain. Acid. Andrew stared at his bare arms in shock. Since when does acid rain actually burn? He wondered. Probably about the same time the deadly toxic fog became a thing. He had to get it off. Ducking through one of the windows, he ran behind the counter and searched frantically for something he could use to dry himself. He found a dirty, dough-crusted apron on the counter and used it to wipe his arms and neck dry. His skin was still tingling, but at least it was no longer burning. A few seconds later, he found the light switches and flicked them all on. His arms were pinkish, but there was no sign of bubbling skin. His jacket was wet, but the shirt underneath was dry. And his jeans? Well, his legs were also tingling, but not burning, so the acid was probably softening up the fibers instead of him. Damn, Andrew muttered, shaking his head. He grabbed a pair of stale, jelly-filled donuts that the burglars had left and went to sit at one of the tables in the far corner of the place. Blinding sheets of acid rain poured down, turning the world white. Rain that actually burns exposed skin. What's next? He wondered as he checked his phone again. Still nothing from Ryan. He thought about calling Selena back, but he didn't have any good news yet. The hours passed slowly and the storm showed no sign of letting up. He ended up brewing himself some coffee, but it took him the better part of an hour to find the beans, grind them, and figure out how to work the machine. By then, the parking lot was flooded with several inches of water. This is ridiculous, Andrew muttered as he sat sipping his coffee and eating another stale donut. He passed the time obsessively checking his phone. The battery was only at 25%, and he'd left the charger in his car. No way he was going out there to get it now. The rain had pooled up over the sidewalk and was starting to seep in through the entrance. If this keeps up, I'm going to need a boat to make it out of here. A flash of lightning and a burst of thunder punctuated that thought, and then the lights died. Great. After another hour, Andrew had to prop his feet up on the opposite chair just to keep them dry. Half an inch of water was sloshing around on the floor. Dusk had fallen and the rain wasn't letting up. Andrew wondered if he should make a run for his truck before things got any worse. But then the steady roar of rain pounding the roof and sidewalk began to fade. Within minutes it was done, and all that remained was the flood, slowly trickling into the storm drains. Andrew stared out into darkness, sipping a cold cup of black coffee. He checked his phone again.
and blinked in shock at the time. 1:09 a.m. Somehow he'd whittled away an entire day, and he still hadn't found Val. A breathless surge of panic rose inside of him. That's it. He dialed Ryan's cell number and waited while the phone rang in his ear.
Andy?
The man answered in a groggy voice.
Yeah, what do you have for me?
Two hits in California with the partials you gave me, but the system was giving me grief. It's too busy, or I don't know. Maybe IT left ahead of everyone else.
Andrew thought he could hear a car engine in the background, his eyes pinched suspiciously.
Where are you, Drake?
Sitting in traffic, a horn honked. Listen, I had to evacuate. They shut the place down and locked it up, but I have two addresses with me. I was just about to call you. You have something to write with?
Hang on.
Andrew ran over behind the donut counter, his boots splashing in the leftovers of the flood. There were napkins, donut boxes, and he spied the ragged edges of a receipt sticking out of one of the credit card readers. Popping the back of it open, he yanked out the roll of paper and unfurled a length of it. Another car horn went off, followed by Ryan's curses.
You still there, Andy?
Yeah.
Casting about once more, Andrew found a pen attached to a chain on the customer's side of the counter. He ripped it free.
Ready.
All right. The first one's in San Diego. The other's up in San Francisco.
Give them to me, Drake.
Ryan dictated the two addresses, and Andrew scrawled them down in a hurry.
You get all that?
Ryan asked.
Yeah, Andrew said.
Good. Hey, listen, man. I understand that you're worried about Val, but I don't need this biting me in the ass later. What are you planning to do when you find these guys?
Less you know, the better. If anyone asks about you running the plates, say you got an anonymous tip. Some looters seen fleeing a 7-Eleven or something.
You're kidding, right?
I have to run, Drake.
You owe me after this, Andy. I'm good for it. Assuming we live long enough for me to cash in. Reporters are saying we've got 7 days before the big one hits.
The big what? Andrew asked.
Everything. Quakes, eruptions, the whole shebang. Make sure you get yourself away from the coast before then.
I'll try.
You better do more than try if you want to live, man. Anyway, see you on the other side, buddy.
See you.
The call ended with a beep. Andrew stared at the receipt roll with the two addresses on it. The light in the store was barely enough to see by, but a quick check with the light of his phone's screen revealed that his writing was legible, at least. He'd check out the one in San Diego first. Hopefully the guy hadn't evacuated yet. Andrew read that name and address aloud, committing it to memory.
David Wilkes, 1960 Edgemont Street, South Park, San Diego, California.
Andrew took a moment to tap that location into his phone's GPS app. It was 6.3 miles away.
Gotcha, you bastard,
he muttered. Andrew tore off the piece of the roll he'd written on and went back to the table where he'd waited out the storm to grab his P320. Dumb mistake, leaving it there while he ran around looking for a pen and paper. He needed to be smarter than that if he was going to live through the coming days. Moments later, he was turning out of the parking lot and then roaring down the street, splashing through residual puddles and pools of water. The streets were a lot emptier now that it was after midnight. When the app reported he was under a mile away, Andrew glanced at his P320 sitting on the passenger's seat beside him. Val used to tease him about having a gun in the car, saying he was paranoid. If Selena had known about the weapon, she'd have refused to ever let their daughter ride with him. As it turned out, though, it was a good thing that he was a paranoid bastard who never left home without a gun. Who knew? He thought with a smirk. But his expression iced over a split second later as he contemplated what he might actually do with that gun if he found Val in Mr. Tesla's house. Andrew turned on the radio to distract himself from the dark turn his thoughts had just taken. The entire West Coast is being evacuated as we speak. What we're looking at is unprecedented in the history of humanity. We're not dealing with one isolated disaster. This could be an extinction-level event. It's as if Mother Nature has finally had enough and she's conspiring against us. Someone else spoke next.
Surely you don't mean to suggest that the planet is actually consciously aware of us and causing these calamities in order to rid itself of us?
Maybe, maybe not. But this sure as hell isn't random. One disaster looming on the horizon, that's normal. Two predicted for the same date, that's just an unfortunate coincidence. Three, well, that's a pattern. But we're talking about hundreds of major disasters all commencing at once. That doesn't happen naturally.
So someone might be causing this.
Someone or something, whatever it is, it's trying to wipe us out. And we have 7 days left to figure out how to stop that from happening.
How can we stop it?
You can't stop a volcano from erupting or a tectonic plate from slipping. There's some experimental tech in the works for the volcanoes, but no, we probably can't stop any of it.
Sobering thoughts, Dr. Cole. Do you have any specific advice for our listeners? What would you recommend that they do right now?
Take shelter, inland, as far as you can get from Yellowstone and Wyoming. Gather as much food and water as you can, fuel and guns, too. The people who make it through this will be the ones who are the most prepared, and whatever you do, don't trust your neighbors. People will be killing each other over a jug of milk soon.
Let's hope not, but I'd like to take a second to answer our more religious listeners. What if this is all supernatural and this really is the beginning of a biblical apocalypse?
The speaker snorted. Then someone better find the Antichrist and string him up before we're all dead. Andrew scowled and stabbed the power button on the radio. He didn't have time for that sensationalist shit.
It's probably all overblown anyway, he decided. Just another damned Y2K. But that acid rain made him wonder.
He drove down a residential street and pulled up in front of David Wilkes's house. It was at the end of a cul-de-sac. He could see the number 1960 emblazoned clearly next to the garage door and on the mailbox out front. Andrew circled around and parked a few blocks over the way he'd come. Grabbing his gun from the passenger seat, he left the truck and locked it with the key fob. Sticking to the shadows between streetlights, he ran down the deserted street. None of these houses had their lights on or cars in the driveways. When he reached the house in question, Andrew pasted himself to the garage door, keeping out of sight of the home's front-facing windows. Then he worked his fingers under the garage door and tried to pry it open. It was a hell of a job to force the door to roll up that first inch, but after that he had a better grip, and the rest was easy. He opened the door enough to slide under. The garage was dark inside. He rolled over, aiming his gun around blindly, waiting for his eyes to adjust to the darkness. Fuzzy shapes became clear around the sides of the garage, along with the obvious fact that the black Tesla wasn't in here. Andrew stood up and pulled his phone out, shining the flashlight around to find the garage perfectly empty